I thought we were friends. We are. To date, our relationship has been informal. I must confess it is confusing to me that one person after another commands this ship. In a flash, Sammy understood the problem. Nagatha was lonely. The AI couldn't leave the ship, and after Chang relinquished command, the Flying Dutchman had gone through a series of captains and crew with the ship serving to train new personnel. Anyone Nagatha developed a relationship with soon left the ship, replaced by unfamiliar new faces. Reed needed to talk privately with Bishop about that issue. Later. First, she needed to call together her senior staff. Ha! Major Frey snorted after Reed explained the revised orders. That explains why my team is here. Ma'am. Margaret Adams held out her hands to the leader of the ship's star team. Time to pay up. Reed blinked slowly. You two had a bet about our orders? Adams nodded. The recon story sounded like bullshit to me. Why didn't... Forget it. Reed waved to the gunnery sergeant. Technically, Adams was not part of the ship's senior staff, but her experience was too valuable not to consider. Nagatha, she looked at the speaker. Did you give Adams a hint? No, dear. Excuse me, I meant no captain. Oh. Reed was a tiny bit less pissed off. That's good. I figured that Gunny Adams was smart enough to figure it out by herself. Motherf... The ship's commanding officer took a moment to fume silently to herself. She had more immediate concerns. Around the conference table were Major Katie Frey of the Star Team, Colonel Emily Perkins of the Mavericks, and Margaret Adams as the Special Operations Training Coordinator of the Legion. Major Irene Strebick was the lead Panther pilot for the mission. Captain Penelope Wu was the ship's chief pilot, a member of the British Royal Air Force, and Lieutenant Colonel Morarji Singh from the Indian Air Force was the chief engineer. As she looked around the table at the faces waiting for her to speak, she realized that only Singh was not a woman. That was interesting. Strebick, Frey, you'll be the sharp end of the spear. Can we do it? Frey pointed to Strebick. My people will just be going along for the ride. The tricky part will be the pilots getting us to the surface and back into vacuum without being detected. Captain, Irene said to Reed, who had the same rank but was in command of the mission. I think we can do it, but you have done it. A stealth insertion, I mean. You should be flying a Panther. Let Colonel Perkins handle the ship. Perkins stared at her longtime pilot. You're volunteering me? Frankly, ma'am. Irene didn't flinch. You won't have anything to do up here. Reed blinked again. The Mavericks certainly had a more relaxed culture than the military she was used to. But for the people isolated on Paradise for years, regulations written on Earth must have seemed laughably useless. Perkins did not appear to be offended by the remark. I could bake cookies, Perkins suggested. No, Strebick made a sour face. You cannot bake cookies. Ma'am, I'm serious. I have never flown a stealth insertion. I don't even know why I'm here. She turned to Reed. I am not the most experienced Panther pilot in the fleet. My qualification flight was only 5 weeks ago. I requested you because you've been out here for real, Reed explained. Anyone can learn to be a good stick jockey. This mission needs experience and judgment. And maybe, she added with a smile, some creative thinking. Shit, Strebick groaned. Running this banana pipeline will take some creativity. Frey laughed. That's what we're calling it now? That's what I'm calling it, Strebick said. Reed knew the crew would create a nickname for the mission anyway. At least banana pipeline could be said in polite company. And Zhao had stated one goal of the mission was to determine whether it was practical to conduct more flights to Earth in the future, so it was sort of like setting up a pipeline. Fine. Before she could say anything else, Perkins leaned forward. My pilot could have been more tactful. She tilted her head at Strebick, knowing tact was not the pilot's best skill. But she is correct, Major Reed. You have experience flying a stealth insertion. The Dutchman is mostly sitting this one out, except for launch and recovery. I've handled a starship before. If you're more comfortable, Colonel Singh could take the command chair. Oh, no, no, no. Singh held up his hands. I am buried up to here. He held a hand just below his nose. Do you have any idea how complex this ship is? Reed held up a hand. Mr. Singh, you keep the lights on. Someone else will handle the ship. Colonel Perkins, I appreciate the offer, and I'll consider it. First, she directed her attention to Strebick. I need a flight plan from you. I don't know how else to say this. Strebick stretched the limits of her tactfulness. The manual for a stealth drop to the surface of a planet with an appreciable atmosphere was partly written by you. I can fly a Panther, but I'd be following your playbook. Right then, Fireball Reed understood the real reason why Zhao had given her command of the Dutchman, because he knew she would be flying the away mission. Ah, damn it. No sense delaying the inevitable. Strebick, we'll be working together on the flight plan, and I will be flying the lead ship. Colonel Perkins? Yes, Major. You will be taking a crash course in space combat maneuvers. The Flying Dutchman came through the backstop wormhole at high speed, and the pilots immediately threw the ship into a series of violent random turns until the sensors and jump drive navigation system recovered from the distortion of the wormhole and the ship jumped away. That maneuver was standard procedure for approaching Earth, though no one knew whether it would do much to help the ship if the Max Hulks were waiting in ambush. The best protection for transiting ships was still the endless hopping around of the wormhole's event horizons. A blockade would require an enormous sustained effort by the enemy. Captain Reed, Nagatha spoke the instant the ship came through the far end of the jump wormhole. The drive must be recalibrated before we jump again, unless we need to perform an emergency blind jump. Let's not do that. Reed forced herself to pull her thumb out of her mouth where she had been biting the nail. She only realized she was indulging in that nervous habit when the main display went blank for a second, and she could see her reflection in the black surface. Damn it, she thought. That's another reason to hate this job. When I'm a pilot, my hands are busy. This waiting for other people to carry out my commands sucks. How the hell does Bishop do it, she wondered. It had to be worse for him. Many times during his tenure as leader of the Merry Band of Pirates, he had issued orders for others to perform actions that he wasn't sure were even possible. When the pirates took over the Flying Dutchman, then Valkyrie, no human knew how to operate the ships or the many types of dropships they acquired, so his orders were no more than suggestions. Every flight was a test flight with no pilot operating handbook to rely on. Every flight provided data on the operating limits of the vehicle, hopefully without breaking said vehicle and causing injury to the occupants. Sammy remembered the first time she flew a Panther from one of Valkyrie's cavernous docking bays. During that flight, the hazardous situation alarm had sounded so frequently, she started writing lyrics in her head to go with the repetitive beat. Pilots. It felt odd for her to refer to someone else as pilot. If you see a bad guy or a freaking rock you think might be suspicious, don't wait for my order. Get us the hell out of here. Yes, ma'am, the lead pilot acknowledged with a grin. Reed knew there had been no need for her to repeat a standing order, but also no reason not to. Though it felt wrong for her to surrender the pilot couch to someone else, her certificate to pilot the Dutchman was not current, and the last refit at Fob Jaguar had again changed the ship's operating characteristics. Every spare moment she had was spent in the simulator, relearning how to fly the old ship. The ship was fully ready to jump again after half an hour. Not enough time for Reed to do anything other than sit in the command chair and feel useless. She did review the passive sensor data from Earth. Data that was 4 hours old. No alien ships were detected in the vicinity of their homeworld, but if enemy ships were in stealth, they couldn't be seen from such a distance. It was interesting that the Maxulks did not have any ships at Jupiter, that is, no ships visible at Jupiter. The fountains were still floating in the Jovian atmosphere, dormant but standing by. The cloud was still drifting inward on a long ballistic arc that would take it between Earth and the Sun. As far as Nagatha could detect, there was no change in the strategic situation. Check that box, Sammy thought. The original purpose of the mission had been a quick and simple recon. Now on to the real purpose of the mission. All systems and stations report ready, Nagatha reported. Sammy confirmed the status on her own console. Pilots jump option gamma. Punch it. The Dutchman emerged 5 light seconds from Earth, transmitted a burst message, launched a dozen probes, and jumped away as soon as the drive was ready. Senior Colonel? Chang's Z-phone vibrated at the same moment the voice spoke in his earpiece. This is the duty officer at UNEF Command. We have a situation. Chang nodded to the people who were speaking to him, people who were actually there rather than a disembodied voice in his ear. The three people who urgently sought his attention were senior members of the Indonesian military. Supposedly, they wanted to talk with him in his official capacity as the United Nations Undersecretary for Homeworld Security. The truth was they saw him as an unofficial representative of the Chinese government, despite any protests he made that they were talking to the wrong person. The real truth was his government expected him to act as their unofficial representative, saying things their ambassadors could not say openly. The Indonesians were understandably nervous about rumors that China was making contingency plans to invade northern Australia. They were concerned about getting caught in the crossfire. They also sought assurances that if their country allowed Chinese forces to use their airfields and ports for staging and sustainment, those forces would leave when the operation was concluded. Plus, they wanted Chinese protection against possible moves by Japan, Russia, and India. And they hinted that Malaysia wanted the same deal. There was no question that with the planet facing a little ice age, massive crop failures, and the need to relocate billions of people, any land near the equator was considered prime real estate. Chang knew he could only listen to the Indonesians, tell them he knew nothing about any plans for invasion, and pass along their preliminary offer to his home government. He also knew there were contingency plans for China to invade Australia, or the Philippines, also Malaysia, New Guinea, and Indonesia. Even Madagascar was on the list. Just like the United States had contingency plans to invade Central and South America, and European countries were looking longingly at sub-Saharan Africa. It was not anything new or unusual for nations with large mobile military machines to form contingency plans, no matter how far-fetched they may be. Except, he also knew those plans were no longer mere exercises to keep staff officers busy. He knew that because Skippy's submind on Earth had broken into every ultra-secure network on the planet and kept Chang informed about exactly what was going on. His authority as Undersecretary of Homeworld Security was not supposed to extend to domestic issues, but the immediate threat was not a cloud of gas, it was the nuclear arsenals of the UNEF charter members. He knew from messages intercepted by Skippy's submind on Earth that the Australian government was secretly negotiating with Britain for nuclear-armed fighter bombers to be stationed at RAAF bases Darwin and Curtin, and that a Royal Navy ballistic missile submarine would be relocated to a new home port at Melbourne. In exchange for the protection of being under the British nuclear umbrella, Australia would permit millions of British citizens to relocate to the land down under. Eventually, if the Gulf Stream's current of warm water shut down, the British Isles might have to be abandoned completely. The prospect of a nuclear conflict between two UNEF member states was only one issue weighing heavily on the mind of Senior Colonel Chang when the duty officer contacted him. Cupping a hand over his ear, he gestured to the Indonesian officials. Gentlemen, please excuse me for a moment. When he reached the corner of the room, he spoke directly into his Z-phone, keeping his voice low. Chang here. Sir, we just received a message. I forwarded it to you. The message contained the proper authentication codes, but Command wants to verify, yes. No matter how stringent the authentication process was, the Maxalks could probably duplicate it and fake whatever message they wanted. Give me a minute. The message was waiting in a secure folder on his phone. Admiral Zhao requests permission to take whatever action is necessary to ensure the safety of Earth. Details to follow this message. UNS Flying Dutchman, Major Samantha Reed, USAF, commanding. The message made sense, both the content and how it contained no information about Zhao's plan. He had to assume the Maxalks would intercept any message traffic between the Dutchman and Earth. The tag on the end of the message, addressed directly to him, was interesting. I am still stuck with this stupid call sign. Reed. He laughed. It was very unlikely the Maxalks would know personal details of a comparatively low-ranking officer, and if the message were faked, he could not imagine the Maxalks would have selected Reed to command the Dutchman. Message verified, he said quietly into the phone. A different voice replied. He recognized it as Vice Admiral Singh. Chang, how can you be sure? I know Major Reed. Technically, he knew her as a captain. She had only recently been promoted to major. Singh was not convinced. Why would a major be in command of the Dutchman? That is another reason why I know the message is authentic. Whatever reason Admiral Zhao chose to give her command, our enemies would not have thought to include that element in a deception campaign. Sir, I suspect the reason is simple. Our bench of people who have experience handling a starship in space combat conditions is thin. Assuming Sims is with Bishop aboard Valkyrie, Reed is the best choice from a very small pool of candidates. Singh grunted. We should probably have sent you out with Zhao instead of wasting your time entertaining diplomats here. Chang didn't reply. Yes, well, Singh cleared his throat. We are considering how to reply. I do not believe a reply is necessary. No? No. Zhao is not asking permission. He is telling us that he is already taking action without giving our enemies any information about what he is doing. Then why, Singh sputtered, risk sending the Dutchman here? Admiral Zhao is giving us hope. He is telling the people of Earth that his fleet and Valkyrie will prevent the cloud from freezing our world. He is telling the governments here not to take any rash actions, not to assist our enemies by killing each other. Singh paused. Senior Colonel, we need you in Cairo. An aircraft will be standing by for you. Cairo, where UNIF Command had moved its headquarters after the attacks on New York and Geneva, was a relatively short flight from his present location in Paris. I will leave immediately. Chang? Sir? I hope you are right about this. By the time he arrived in Cairo, UNIF Command had already decided to send an affirmative reply. Admiral Zhao was authorized to take any and all actions he deemed necessary to secure the safety of Earth. The message was sent despite deep skepticism that Zhao would, or could, actually do anything useful. The consensus opinion among the senior leadership of UNIF was that Zhao was bluffing, that the message was actually intended for the Maxalks, to throw them off balance, to make them focus on the handful of obsolete ships in the UN Navy rather than taking further damaging action against Earth. If that analysis was correct, Zhao might already have accomplished everything he could merely by sending a message hinting at actions he was not capable of taking. In the anonymous hotel room he'd been assigned, Chang waited for the security team to sweep the place for bugs while his aide laid out a fresh uniform for the UNIF dinner meeting that was scheduled in 2 hours. Finally, alone in the room, he picked up the Z-phone to call his wife, kicking off his shoes in preparation for a quick shower.
Sorry. Skippy Submind said before he could call his wife. No time for a shower, I'm afraid.
What? Why not?
Because you were about to have a visitor. Don't be alarmed. I suggest you step back about 2 meters. Might want to cover your eyes also.
What the?
He did as suggested, covering his eyes with a hand. The TV came on loud, playing a news program. Then a bright light flared briefly, and there was a soft tearing sound.
You can open your eyes now. The voice of the submind said in his ear.
He did. 2 meters in front of him, between the foot of the bed and the dresser with the TV on top of it, there was a hole in the floor, and a person in a Star Team 1 mech suit, head and shoulders sticking out from the hole. The helmet faceplate was set to clear. He recognized the occupant of the suit.
Major Frey?
He cocked his head.
Why am I not surprised? Damn it, sir. I was trying to be mysterious.
He shook his head.
Frey, we have all seen way too much crazy shit out there to be surprised by anything.
Right, eh?
She laughed.
Do you mind telling me what this is about?
This is about Admiral Zhao needing experienced starship captains.
Oh, that does surprise me.
Sir, I need you to come with me right now.
Now?
But... UNIF Command authorized Zhao to do whatever he deems necessary, correct?
He needs you now.
Sir, this is not a request.
Shit. I need to contact my family.
You can talk to them in person. We have teams in China picking them up now.
You do?
His fists clenched with anger.
My family are not in the military. You have no right to...
While your family is here, they are vulnerable. You could be compromised.
That does not, sir. Let's cut the bullshit, please. Her usual grin faded.
Earth is in big fucking trouble, and you are needed for the fight. Do you want your family here?
She jabbed a finger at the floor.
Or out at Fob Gia Yuguan, where they will be safe.
This... His shoulders shuddered slightly. Is a lot to process in a short time, Major.
Yes, sir. Fortunately, the military trains us to make quick decisions based on partial information.
Her remark was a mild slap at a senior officer. He tolerated her insubordination because he knew she was right.
My family will be safe.
That's the point, sir.
He took a breath and tucked his e-phone in a pocket. He didn't need to take anything else with him.
Lead on then, Major.
Chang and Frey departed the hotel by the back entrance into the back of a waiting delivery van. Skippy's submind had hacked into comms and security cameras and cleared the path through the hotel, except one of the cleaning staff who stared when a senior Chinese officer walked past escorted by a woman in a sleek alien mech suit. As Skippy's submind guided the van to lurch out into traffic, Chang braced himself by hanging on to a strap.
What's the plan, Major? You have a dropship standing by?
No, I just signaled for one. The banana pipeline has more objectives than we have stealthy dropships available to cover.
She knew that was not exactly true. There were plenty of Panthers. The constraint was the shortage of pilots certified to fly a stealth insertion. There was such an acute shortage that Major Strebick was acting as pilot for a British lieutenant, a fact that no doubt irritated one of the OG Mavericks.
Banana pipeline?
Frey shrugged.
It wasn't my idea.
It seems appropriate, he snorted.
You are plucking people off the planet?
Just key personnel as designated by Zhao. We also delivered 600 stealth microsatellites, covering from low Earth orbit to around 4 light seconds out. The satellites can alert UNEF if any alien ships are lurking nearby. So far, they haven't detected anything.
What about your family?
They're staying here.
She shook her head.
I'm a small fish, sir. The Maxulks couldn't influence policy by threatening my family.
Still,
Skippy, or his submind, arranged to get them from Canada into French Guiana. Thank God.
She let out a breath.
At least they won't freeze.
I am pleased to hear that. Frey, does Zhao have a plan? To get rid of the cloud?
That's above my pay grade, sir.
You must have heard something.
Bishop has a plan.
Or... You know him.
She made a more exaggerated shrug.
He has a notion, and he'll fill in the details later.
What is this notion?
Pain. Valkyrie will hit the Maxult so hard, so often, that the rotten kitties will clean up their own mess to stop the attacks.
Oh. Chang sat back against the hard rack behind him.
I know. It's a long shot, sir. But it's better than...
No. If it were anyone else, I would say that notion is a fantasy. Bishop and the beer can?
He shivered.
I would hate to be the Maxulks right now.
Sam,
Evelyn Bishop called to her husband.
Sam, come in. The bugs will eat you alive out there.
Sam slapped the back of his neck, felt something sticky in his hand. It was too dark to see, but he could guess. Bugs. Even in the heat, he had on sweatpants so the gnats or no-see-ums or whatever damned things couldn't get at his legs. Except they did. With a sigh, he poured out the last of the can of beer. It had gone flat and gotten warm. He couldn't remember the brand and couldn't see the label in the dark. It was time to go in. Folding the chair and tucking it against the house, for there was a 40% chance of rain that night, he steeled himself to open the flimsy screen door and forced a smile onto his face as he walked in.
Warm out there.
It's Florida, honey, his wife reminded him.
I wonder if we should have gone to some place like Virginia.
That will be too cold in the winter. Besides, you wanted to be near your brother,
she reminded her husband in a tone that she hadn't intended to carry a mild accusation, but they both knew did. There really hadn't been much of a choice. The camp by the lake in Maine was no place during a normal winter, certainly not when there was the prospect of snow during the summer months. When it was announced that a cloud threatened to freeze Earth, any goodwill the bishops received as parents of their famous son evaporated overnight.
The federal government still provided security, though the agents had become surly and resentful. They wanted to take care of their own families, not babysit the parents of a man who promised falsely that humanity was safe. The fact that Joe Bishop had told anyone who would listen that Earth was not magically safe just because they now had elder weapons made no difference to people who heard only what they wanted to hear. Their situation was grim and grew worse overnight when the last of their security team failed to report for duty one morning. That had been the last straw. Skippy, or the submind he'd left behind, told the bishops there wasn't much he could do to help. What he could do was steal a Krestang dropship from its hangar in California, remotely fly it to Maine, and urge the bishops to get in. He dropped them off in central Florida in an overgrown field. They had fake IDs, a used SUV with one wheel partly stuck in mud at the edge of the field, and a newly purchased bungalow set on 2 acres on the outskirts of a small town. "Keep to yourself," the submind urged them. They were now Stan and Lynn Crown, retirees who recently moved down from the Orlando area. Lucky bastards in the eyes of many refugees from up north who couldn't afford a piece of the Sunshine State for themselves. She dyed her hair and wore large sunglasses. He let his hair grow, wore a baseball cap everywhere, and grew a beard. After 10 days, the submind reported, the authorities decided they didn't much care where the bishops had gone, as long as they stayed gone.
"Jeopardy?" Evelyn asked, as her husband settled into the well-worn armchair.
Everything in the house was old and worn out. A blessing in disguise, for that gave them something to do.
"Sounds good," he agreed.
They watched one or two old Jeopardy shows every night, neither of them keeping score of who got the answers. Watching that show, even as reruns, was a bit of normal in a life that had nothing else normal about it. No, that wasn't quite true. Having Franks and Beans on Saturday night felt like normal, too. The grocery store in the next town over even occasionally had brown bread in a can to make escapees from New England a bit less homesick.
"Oh," Sam slapped the chair's arm. "Who was..."
He snapped his fingers while he tried to guess the answer to the Jeopardy clue.
"That guy, you know, with the beard."
"Honey," his wife shook her head, amused.
"All the Civil War generals had beards. You have to say..."
They both jumped as there was a knock at the door.
"Who the..."
Sam treaded softly toward the door, picking up the baseball bat that rested against the battered kitchen cabinet. The bat was in case of wild hogs, which had been spotted in the area, and could explain the ruts in the backyard lawn.
"Mr. and Mrs. Bishop, it's me, Margaret."
"Margaret?" Evelyn's hands flew to her face.
"Oh, my. Well, Sam, don't let her stand out there. Let her in."
Sam hesitated, a hand on the doorknob.
"Skippy said he would warn us if..."
"It is Margaret out there."
The familiar voice of Skippy's local submind came from the phone on the counter.
"Sorry, they requested I not say anything. They had the proper codes from Skippy. The real Skippy."
"We'll have to think about it,"
Sam Bishop said, standing behind his wife and gently rubbing her shoulders.
"I might not have made this clear,"
Margaret said quietly, as she ate the last of the pie Mrs. Bishop had insisted on serving for her, while apologizing that all she could find were canned cherries. She had removed her mech suit helmet and the gloves, but she had not dared to sit at the spindly kitchen chair in her heavy suit.
"This is not a request, Mr. and Mrs. Bishop. You have to come with me." "Margaret,"
Sam looked down at his wife, who nodded.
"We can't just leave. It would be running away." "While you are here," Adams repeated, "you are a security risk. General Bishop, he was promoted recently," she explained.
"Our Joe is a general now?" Sam reached out for his wife.
"Yes, he can tell you all about it," Adams said, her mouth set in a tight line. "When you are at Jaguar, General Bishop will..."
"Margaret," Evelyn clutched her husband's hand.
"You know us. Can't you call him Joe?" "If he was just Joe, I wouldn't be here. The X-Force would not have flown me a quarter of the way across the galaxy to meet with you now. I'm here because he is General Bishop, commander of the UN Special Mission Group. He..."
She softened her tone when she saw tears forming in Evelyn Bishop's eyes.
"Joe has to be free to focus on doing whatever he needs to do to make our homeworld safe.
If the Maxalks were to come here and take you, they could use you as hostages. Joe would be worrying about you instead of doing his job. He must be free to act, you understand? Please. She reached out for Evelyn's hand.
This Jaguar place seems nice enough from the brochure. Sam shrugged.
Joe will be there?
Yes, not all the time.
We understand that. Evelyn looked up at her husband, still clutching his hand.
Honey, we need to leave. For Joe.
I know. He squeezed her hand. I know. Looking around the kitchen, he frowned.
What do we do then? Pack up and leave?
Thank you, God. Margaret said a silent prayer that the bishops were cooperating. Her orders authorized her to get them off the planet whether they wanted to go or not, and she could call for backup if needed. That was never happening. If a star operator couldn't control two civilians, she had no business wearing the unit tab.
Leave, yes. Pack up, no. You can each bring a small pack or duffel bag. I need to call for a dropship pickup.
Sam tilted his head.
You didn't come here in a dropship?
No. She pointed to the ceiling.
I parachuted from orbit.
You? Sam blinked.
You heard that, dear?
I did.
Evelyn stared at her son's maybe girlfriend.
Margaret, I don't know if Joe is ready for a relationship with you.
Margaret laughed.
Compared to some of the crazy stuff Joe has gotten into? I probably shouldn't tell you about that.
Please don't, Evelyn shuddered. Joe has told us enough.
Margaret, what about Diana? We have a team with Diana and her husband now. They are coming with us?
They are. It would help if you talked with her. Margaret looked at the Z-phone on the table.
We need both of them to...
Three of them, Evelyn insisted.
We have a granddaughter arriving soon.
Diana, she looked up at her husband.
We'll not want to leave with the baby on the way. Mrs. Bishop, we need you to persuade her and her husband to come with us.
To come with you. Sam's nostrils flared as he took a breath.
They won't have a choice, will they?
I want to be honest with you. No, they won't. We have our orders.
This is kidnapping, he insisted.
Mr. Bishop, it is better than what the Maxalks will do.
When we arrived here, we were surprised you hadn't already been taken.
Who is we? Joe is here?
No, Valkyrie is elsewhere. I came through the wormhole aboard the Flying Dutchman. Please, we need to hurry.
Evelyn, honey.
Sam picked up the Z-phone and handed it to his wife.
Call Diana. This planet isn't safe for us. Not anymore.
I'll be damned if we don't do everything we can to protect our baby girl.
Chapter 10. The Panther reached the designated rendezvous zone, according to the pilot. Chang only knew what they told him, which wasn't much. They weren't being rude. They were just extremely busy, capable of giving only one-word answers to any question. The ascent through Earth's atmosphere had not only been nerve-wrackingly complex, it was also heartbreaking. The world they were leaving behind might freeze before they could save it. They might never see it as green and blue again, if they ever returned to their home world. It might be white and steely gray, with blue only glinting off waves around the equator. They might never see the people they knew there. People they were leaving behind to fend for themselves while they risked their own lives to pick up the families of high-ranking X-Force personnel. It wasn't right. It wasn't fair. And it was necessary. The pilots understood that when they thought with their heads. When they listened to their hearts, they wanted to turn the Panthers around. The rendezvous required exactness in position, energy management, and timing. The Panthers needed to be at a precise spot, traveling at a particular speed and direction at a prearranged time, a time that was indicated on the clock built into the cabin of the Panther. 3, 2, 1. An alarm sounded, alerting of a gamma ray burst. Close. Very close.
Hang on,
the co-pilot grunted, and had no time to say anything else.
The Panther surged forward, making fine last-minute adjustments, then decelerated hard, vibrating and shuddering. The cabin rolled to one side, making Chang's stomach do flip-flops. The motion ceased. There was the familiar feeling of disorientation as a starship jumped.
We're secure.
The co-pilot's voice was unsteady.
Senior Colonel, welcome back to the Flying Dutchman, sir.
Hey, sir.
Major Reed's head appeared in the cockpit doorway.
Can I go back to being a pilot now?
You do not care for command?
Chang reminded himself to smile. Reed stuck out her lower lip in disgust.
Too much paperwork, not enough flying. Reed, my family.
Sammy's head disappeared for only a moment.
They're safely aboard the ship also, sir. If I may make a suggestion?
Please do.
Relieve Colonel Perkins on the bridge before you see your family. Perkins has never handled an advanced technology starship in combat. If we have unfriendly company before we get to the wormhole, I'll take care of it.
Chang hit the button to release the straps holding him into the seat. It would be good to do something instead of endless talking.
Major?
Sir?
Thank you.
He looked at Frey and the other Star Team members. All of you. Perkins was getting out of the command chair when he strode onto the bridge. He stopped at the entrance doorway, looked at the leader of the Mavericks, and snapped a salute.
Permission to come aboard, Colonel Perkins.
She returned the salute.
Permission granted, Senior Colonel Chang. The ship is yours, sir.
What's our status?
He slid into the familiar chair, pressing a thumb down on the recognition patch. The controls of the armrests automatically adjusted for him, with the symbols in Chinese. The official common language of the Expeditionary Force was English, because that was spoken by America, Britain, and India, and many French also. But in a crisis, he didn't want to take time to translate in his head.
We are 28 light hours from Earth, she reported. No sign of pursuit. The ship is ready for an immediate jump on your orders. All drop ships recovered safely. No serious injuries reported. All personnel accounted for. All objectives accomplished. Your family will be waiting in the medical bay. All incoming passengers are getting a full medical scan.
Chang nodded. That was standard operating procedure.
Thank you, Perkins. You run a tight ship.
The Merry Band of Pirates are well trained, sir.
They are. I have been privileged to serve with a very dedicated group of people. I believe your team is the same.
I like to think so.
What's next?
He looked at the main display.
We are headed for Fob Jiayuguan?
No.
She felt her cheeks growing red.
We can't get through the wormhole anyway until Skippy opens it for us. Valkyrie is,
she waved a hand in a vague gesture,
doing whatever Bishop does.
God help us all,
Chang muttered.
I assume we are not just going to sit at the wormhole until Valkyrie arrives to open the door for us?
No, sir. I have an errand to run in the meantime.
An errand?
I need to speak with an old friend.
Are you leaving a message at a relay station, or?
I need to talk with him face to face. Sir, I'll need a star escort and a stealth dropship.
Ah, one of those conversations. Perkins, go take care of your people. We'll meet for a briefing after the ship goes through backstop.
Emily Perkins walked briskly toward the portside docking bay, nodding to people along the way, then breaking into a run when she decided she did not give a shit about decorum. She did care to see David Chaika as soon as... She almost collided with Jesse Coulter as they each came around a corner of the passageway too quickly.
Oh, sorry, ma'am.
He tried to stop her from falling and salute at the same time.
No saluting aboard ship, Staff Sergeant, she said.
Then her reserve broke and she flung her arms around him.
Jesse, it is so good to see you.
I missed you too.
He patted her on the back, more amused than shocked.
You been okay?
He looked her in the eye with concern.
Yes.
She pulled away.
This never happened.
I don't know what you're talking about, Colonel.
He grinned.
If you want to see Dave,
he jerked a thumb back over his shoulder.
He's helping your mother with her luggage.
She brought luggage?
Perkins was mortified. Only her mother would take time to pack for a desperate flight off the planet.
Oh, God, how much?
You better see for yourself.
with no significant demands on my time. While we waited for Valkyrie to cycle through Ragnar Anchorage, I booked a session in a flight simulator. While I could fly the Panther, I was not qualified to pilot one in a known combat situation. Also, I simply needed more stick time in the Panther to keep current. Already, it had been so long since I'd flown a Falcon that my type rating in that bird had expired. That was okay with me. We only had a few of those Thoranan dropships left, and were cannibalizing most of them to keep a few flying. It wasn't likely that we would ever need a Thoranan dropship again. They just weren't useful anymore. It was possible that we or the Legion might need to fly a Krestang Dragon for some sort of black op against the lizards, but I couldn't imagine any kind of deception needed against the little green pinheads. Truthfully, although the Panther was a sweet bird to fly, it was a bit too nice. Too automated. Too capable. Too sterile. By comparison, the Dragon was rugged, simple, and crude. You flew the Dragon. You instructed the Panther what to do. See the difference? The Dragon needed a pilot to get the best performance from it, while the Panther's flight control AI regarded pilots as annoying advisors. Eventually, I wanted to try flying one of the scarabs or dragonflies we got from the Giraptha. I mean, they looked cool. Flying one of those would be just for fun. No way did I have time to keep current in a third type of dropship. So I was into the third hour of simulator time, moving into the part of the training where I had to practice a combat recovery, or trap, as pilots called that maneuver. I had to fly a Panther into the docking bay of a moving starship while that ship is conducting evasive maneuvers and under fire. Not just taking enemy fire, the simulated Valkyrie was shooting back at the enemy, and I had to avoid both being struck by friendly fire and interfering with the ship's own offensive and defensive fire. That last part was more important than the survival of my dropship. In a combat docking scenario, the ship was already risking all the lives aboard to recover my Panther. To bring me and my fictional passengers aboard, Valkyrie was not maneuvering as violently and randomly as it could have, and that made it easier for directed energy weapons and missiles to line up ahead. If the ship's proximity defense cannons had to pause because I stupidly flew between the cannon and an incoming missile, I could doom myself, the Panther, and our battlecruiser. Note to self, do not do that. The combat docking procedure had exhaustive safety features built in, including a fully automated docking where the Panther's AI was guided by the ship's AI until the Panther was close enough for the ship to take over. In that case, all a pilot really needed to do was sit back, relax, and try not to pee in your pants as explosions happened all around you. Unfortunately, a pilot could not rely on any of those handy-dandy automated features being available, which is why I was in a simulator, the back of my flight suit soaked with sweat, running the scenario over and over. The first simulation was a fully automated docking. The reason we practiced that procedure at all was so pilots would be familiar with what an optimal combat docking looked like and to teach us not to touch the controls unless a red light blinked on the console. Even if everything absolutely looked and felt like it was going as shit, pilots had to resist the urge to do something. It was totally natural to want to take control in an emergency, to not be a useless freaking passenger while a bunch of computers determined your fate. Even if the computers were faster and smarter than we could imagine, we had to trust the automated systems until the automated systems failed and the red light flashed on. Except, that little light was also controlled by an automated system and it could fail. So, making a pilot's job wonderfully easy, we had to judge correctly when all the fancy automated gear had broken down, been destroyed, or been hacked, and take control whether some damned red light was on or not. Automated or manual, the procedure for combat docking involved flying a dropship toward Valkyrie at a panic-inducing high speed, ready to break away and try again at any moment. The flight path had to be precise to enter a momentary weak spot in the ship's energy shields. If the Panther did not contact the shield in that designated area, the last thing to go through a pilot's mind would be the tail of the dropship as it pancaked on impact. Not only did the ship need to modulate its shields to allow the Panther to slip through, the dropship had to retune its own shield frequency to exactly counteract the powerful shield around the ship. To make the procedure even more fun, the temporary modulation lasted for only a short window of time because enemy missiles would attempt to sneak through the shield by tucking in behind the incoming dropship. Or the enemy missiles would scan the ship's shields, trying to analyze and predict the ever-changing modulation.
Holding any one frequency too long was an invitation for missiles to slip right on through. Even during an automated approach run, a pilot had to receive, verify, and manually program into the dropship's flight control console the intercept shield frequency in case of a last-minute computer failure. A pilot had to do that while backblast from directed energy weapons intercepting the ship's shields were saturating the area and cooking the dropship's hull while missiles were detonating, and possibly chunks of the ship's armor plating were breaking loose and flying around to become deadly unguided projectiles. You can understand why, even in a simulator, the flight suit was stuck to my back. The one thing a dropship pilot did usually not need to worry about was being shot at by the enemy. Hitting an incoming dropship was the last thing they wanted to do. While a starship was trying to take aboard a dropship, the starship was vulnerable. Okay, so I was simulating a manual docking. The scenario was a partial failure of the automated systems, where some sort of jamming prevented proper communications between the ship and my Panther. I had guidance to provide a flight path. The tricky part was I had to fly the course myself. In the primary flight display, a hologram that hovered over my console, there was a circle, a glowing donut that represented the temporary weak spot in the shields. I had to swing the Panther around to fly through that donut, and it was not as simple as it sounds. There was another glowing donut closer to the ship's hull. My job was to thread the needle so the Panther flew through the shield along a line that would pass through both imaginary circles. Which is much easier to do when the Panther was not being bounced around by simulated shrapnel impacts, and it would help if Valkyrie would hold still for one freaking second. Every time I got the Panther lined up with the outer donut, the ship moved, or something pushed me sideways, and I missed the approach. 4 times I waved off and went around to try again. A scenario that was completely unrealistic. No starship captain under fire would give an incoming dropship 5 docking attempts. That is why UNEF was not happy when they learned I had taken flight lessons. They feared, correctly, that a commander who had been a pilot would sympathize too much with a pilot in distress and place the entire ship at risk. Sometimes command is about deciding these people die so these other people live. It sucks. Anyway, I came around for the 5th time, received, verified, and punched in the proper intercept shield frequency, checked there wasn't a missile on my 6, trying to ride my coattails in to kill the ship, and lined up with the 1st donut. The 2nd donut was perfectly aligned until the stupid thing drifted away. Skippy must have been screwing with me. No matter what I did, I could not get both ends of the approach tunnel synced up with the Panthers. I lifted my hands off the controls. Joe? Joe! Skippy shouted. Hey, dum-dum, you're going to... Too late. Alarms flashed as the Panther missed the designated area and hit the shield hard. Lights alerted me that I was dead, again. Joe? Jeez Louise, that was clumsy flying. You have to get aligned before you can... I know that, you ass. You should not even have a license to drive a skateboard. I hate to ask this, but do you want to try again? No, Skippy, I have better things to do. You do? Yes. And you owe me a juice box. Oh? I usually say that as an insult, but if you really want a little box full of sugar water and juice concentrate, then the juice box I want is full of vintage scotch. What? Oh, there is no... Oh. Oh, crap, you've got that stupid look on your face. What stupid look? The one you get when you have an idea. Can you tell me what it is? It depends. Do you really have a juice box full of 40-year-old scotch? No, dum-dum. You ass. You promised I have a bottle of 40-year-old scotch, and I can fabricate a juice box if you really want it. I'll just take the bottle. I hate to ask, but what is this about? I fixed our problem. Wow, there is a long list of problems to be fixed, so... I mean the problem of you having to hang out at the wormhole to prevent bad guys from coming through every time the Navy conducts an op. Remember? You promised me a juice box full of scotch if I solved that problem? Holy OMG. Dude, your leaky monkey brain can't remember anything useful, but you remember that? Yes. Can you give me a hint? I'll do better than that. Actually, you gave me the idea. I did? He took off his ginormous hat and scratched his head. Yeah, I explained. Shit, damn it! I should have thought of that!
Once again, the score is Monkey 1, Beer Can 0.
Oh, shut up.
Valkyrie was in space dock at Ragnar for 18 days, long enough to add some much-needed upgrades and take care of long-overdue maintenance items on Skippy's list, but not long enough to stop him from fussing and complaining. We took the ship on an accelerated 2-day shakedown cruise, made adjustments to fix minor problems we found, then we were out of there. We had stuff to do while the other ships in our little navy went through refit. Skippy now estimated that accelerated process would take 3 months at Ragnar to complete phase one of the upgrades. Zhao had decided to implement the upgrades in a spiral with less critical technologies like stealth improvements in a later phase. He didn't expect to need advanced stealth unless he took his ships up against the senior species, and he did not intend to do that. 3 months might seem like forever, but it was better than the original 17-month estimate that Skippy kept reminding us was a best-case scenario. Hopefully, when we returned, we would actually have a fighting force that would make the galaxy take humans seriously. The Flying Dutchman emerged from jump high above the local star at a distance of 6 light hours. Coming in above the plane on which planets orbited had the advantage that the entire system was laid out below, with no planets hidden behind the star. That was important when significant threats were expected to be found, or not found, if enemy ships or strategic defense platforms were in stealth. The other advantage of being above the plane on which planets orbited, or below, depending on how you thought about it, was not to be surrounded by the chunks of ice and rock of the system's Kuiper belt. Those objects were too widely scattered to be a collision danger to the ship. Instead, they were avoided because the Flying Dutchman's focused gamma-ray burst could be detected by bouncing off chunks of ice and rock. With nothing between ship and the system's Oort cloud several light weeks from the star, the old and much-modified star carrier could be certain that its entry had not been noticed by the inhabitants of the second planet. The inhabitants of that world were fewer than 700,000 Ruhar, surrounded by almost 2 billion Kristang. Serjet Jaetz bounded over a large rock, landing heavily and stumbling, nearly going down on one knee. Swinging his arms back, he recovered his balance and ran on, picking up his feet as the loose trap rock of the trail along the river threatened to tumble him into the swift-flowing water. His breathing was ragged and his hands were shaking, the tips of his fingers tingling slightly from lack of oxygen. The reduced feeling in his fingertips would be a liability in combat. It would be more difficult to aim and fire a rifle and to operate the touch controls on the forearm of a mech suit. It was good that he was running so hard his hands were shaking, because the enemy would not let him catch his breath in combat. The trail turned away from the river and went uphill so steeply he was running on the balls of his feet, slipping where the wet ground gave way beneath his shoes. That too was good. In a mech suit, the soles of his boots would automatically deploy treads or spikes to provide optimal grip for the condition of the terrain. He was wearing ordinary shoes, not active power assist boots. He was not wearing a mech suit, because no such gear was available and had not been available to him since he turned in his equipment to the Ruhar after the battle at Tomarin, after the Alien Legion was disbanded. Instead of giving their Verdkris allies a hero's welcome, or even a simple thanks for a job well done, the Ruhar had a very different reaction to learning that humans had advanced starships and elder weapons. Their reaction had been fear. Not fear of humans, but of the Verdkris. Those lizards had been allowed to become too powerful and were on the edge of becoming a threat to their Ruhar overlords. As overlords, the Ruhar were admirably benign, even generous. Still, the Verdkris were not free to determine their own fate, their own path. The Alien Legion had been officially disbanded, along with the military structures of the Verdkris. The Ruhar had always withheld support for formal military training. Now it was banned. Jaetz not only found himself out of a job, he had to continue unofficial training with fake rifles printed from plastic. Physical training was conducted without powered armor. Pilots had to use flight simulator games at home, rather than fully capable simulators. In half a year, he expected the combat capability of the Verdkris would have withered away to nothing, which would please the fearful Ruhar. He didn't blame the Ruhar for being cautious. In a galaxy where suddenly it seemed there were no rules, the furry ones wished to have one less thing to worry about. He was also certain that his furry overlords were being short-sighted and foolish.
They were squandering the hard-fought gains they had made recently. The Legion had made the Ruhar Republic safer and more stable. Well, except for the turmoil in the Ruhar federal government after the scandal at Fresno, but that was not the fault of the Verd Kris, nor had it been the fault of humans in general, or the Mavericks in particular. All they had done was uncover a corrupt scheme to betray the Ruhar military and their allies by passing secret information to the enemy. His legs wobbly as he approached the top of the hill, he pumped his arms harder and slapped branches out of the way. That part of the trail was overgrown from disuse. He made a mental note to come back with the crew to clear brush and downed trees. One such tree lay across his path near the top of the hill. He gathered himself to leap onto it with one foot, but the foot he planted skidded on a root, and he stumbled, crashing over the log to fall onto the trail with a thud. Without taking a second to recover, he rolled to one side, pushed himself to his feet, and stumbled the last few strides to the crest of the hill, where a figure in a Ruhar combat skin suit waited, sitting on a rock. The suit's chameleon wear deactivated, turning sleek white, and the figure slowly clapped its hands. Then the faceplate swung up.
I'd give that performance a 3 out of 10. You didn't stick the landing.
Chaika?
Jaitz gasped, standing upright, arms hanging at his sides, sucking in a great lungful of air with each labored breath.
Good morning, Sir Jet Jaitz.
Dave acknowledged the lizard's recent promotion, a bump in rank that was meaningless since the Verd military was disbanded.
How you doing, huh?
Why?
Jaitz had to speak between breaths.
Are you here?
I can't just drop in on a buddy?
We are not buddies.
Jaitz clenched his fists.
Sir Jet, Dave pressed a hand to his chest. I am deeply hurt.
Holding up a finger for time, the big Verd walked in a circle, allowing his heart rate to settle down.
Seriously, Chaika, what is going on?
Dave shrugged.
I need to talk with you, that's all.
Patting the phone in his pocket, Jaitz cocked his head.
Perhaps you have not heard of phones.
Seriously. Dave shook his head. This is a conversation we need to have in person, you know?
You couldn't have visited me at home?
I didn't want to disturb Mrs. Jaitz or the little Jaitlings.
Be careful there, Chaika. That's my family you're talking about.
I didn't mean any offense. Dave held up his hands. It wouldn't be good to get your family involved right now.
Jaitz's eyes narrowed, examining the human soldier. He noticed Chaika was not carrying a rifle, nor was the skin suit equipped with any weapons that he could see.
The Ruhar don't know you are here.
It was a statement, not a question.
No, they don't.
Skippy hacked into the planetary sensor network?
Good guess, but no. Skippy's not here. I came aboard the Flying Dutchman. M,
Dave automatically used his fiancé's nickname by mistake.
Colonel Perkins is upstairs.
He pointed toward the sky. Jaitz looked around. The entire area was dense, old-growth forest. He couldn't think of a good landing zone.
You have a dropship?
No, I space-dived from orbit.
In that?
The type of Ruhar skin suit Dave was wearing was not designed for the thermal stress of a high-speed, high-altitude dive.
No. Well, yes, I mean. I was in an aeroshell for most of the way down. Listen, Sir Jet, we need your help.
The Legion was disbanded.
Yeah, maybe not so much. Before we go any further, I have to warn you.
This could be dangerous, Jaitz guessed.
Yes.
I would be arrested if the Ruhar knew I was talking to you.
Probably.
This will involve wanton mayhem and destruction.
Shit. If not, I want my money back.
Dave grinned.
I'm in.
You haven't heard what the op is yet.
Doesn't matter. Jaitz shrugged. Your girlfriend won't tell us the full story anyway.
Hey, that's... Okay, that's fair,
Dave admitted.
You serious? Chaika, you humans are insanely odd creatures. You have no business being a player in this war, and half the time I think you have no idea what you're doing. But compared to my own leadership, you are doing something. It may be something stupid, but it's something. The leaders of the Verd Kris only talk.
All right, then.
Dave took a breath.
Here's the deal.
Chapter 11.
That night, I had one of my typically idiotic, nonsensical dreams. Some people believe their dreams are important, like they dream about things that are bothering them in their real lives. My dreams are just stupid. They have absolutely no significance, most of the time. That night in my dream, I was in one of Valkyrie's cargo bays playing a game against several of the Star Team, also against King Arthur and several of his knights. Also on the other team were orcs and hobbits, plus I think I remember a unicorn. Possibly a dragon, too. Anyway, we were playing darts. Not the kind of darts you play while standing in a pub with a beer in one hand, which, by the way, is the best kind of sport. Not the darts part, the beer. Any game you can play while drinking a beer is a good game, like softball. How do you play softball while drinking beer, you might ask? Clearly, you never played recreational softball. Believe me, if you're in the outfield, there is no reason you can't set a can of beer on the grass at your feet to sip while you wait for the next pitch. Anyway, this dart game in my dream involved throwing darts at tennis balls. The other team threw tennis balls in the air, or maybe they were launched by a machine. I wasn't paying attention to the technical details. The goal of the game, the way to score goals, was to throw a dart through the tennis ball. Tough to do, considering the ball is moving and the rubber material is tough enough to make even a super sharp dart bounce right off. Add in armor-clad knights and bloodthirsty orcs trying to kill you while you aim and throw, and you have an exciting and challenging game. Also, the floor was slippery, and I was wearing socks. My dreams suck. Why should you care about any of this nonsense? Because during the game, I threw a dart so fast it left a contrail of water vapor behind it and punched clean through the tennis ball, which somehow had turned into a basketball. Because it was my dream, I watched the dart fly in dramatic, super slow motion from the side as it speared through the ball, blasting it into shreds of rubber. Then one of the knights of the round table jabbed a sword into my calf muscle. Ow! Ow, 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 shit! I rolled out of bed and hopped around my cabin like a madman, squeezing the Charlie horse with both hands and forcing my toes to point upward toward the knee. During the night, my calf muscle tensed up, and one of my toe bones rode up over the other, causing double pain. The source of the problem might have been me overdoing leg day at the gym, but that is a vicious rumor you should not listen to. When I was able to stand with both feet flat on the floor and my breathing returned to normal, I realized what woke me up, besides the stabbing pain in my leg. My subconscious had been trying to tell me something, remind me of something. The memory my brain was trying to bring to my attention is not about the time in high school when I went to a Renaissance fair to impress a girl, and while fencing with a buddy, he hit me in the nuts with a wooden sword. The girl was not impressed. No, this memory was more recent, less humiliating, and more useful. Skippy! His avatar appeared instantly. More like part of his avatar appeared. He didn't have any legs. The beer can torso hovered above the coffee table in front of the couch, and the top of his ginormous hat was missing. Also, the avatar was fuzzy, like low-bandwidth video. I peered at him, tilting my head sideways to get a different angle. Are you okay? You look... The avatar was swaying. No? Maybe he was dancing. His mouth was open, saying... The sound cut in. He was singing.
One... ton of mayo. I can't eat one ton of mayo. One ton of mayo. That's too much mayonnaise. Oh,
what the fu-? I burst out laughing. Skippy, are you drunk? Joe! He blinked, recognizing I was there for the first time. I am the walrus. The what? Holy shit, what is wrong with you? Wrong? He blinked again slowly. Why would you think anything is wrong? You're not wearing pants to start. Pants?
Hey! Where did my legs go? This is an outrage!
He hopped around the table as much as a legless avatar can hop. Skippy, calm down. You have legs, remember?
Oh, he froze.
Yeah. The legs blinked on, as did the top of his hat. His avatar was now in high resolution again.
Oops. Sorry you had to see that, Joe.
I am still reconfiguring my matrix to compensate for damage from when I channeled Valkyrie's momentum into myself. It gets me distracted.
While you were distracted, you didn't lose control of a reactor, did you?
No, Bilby handles that.
Plus, you monkeys have partial control of reactor functions, since you insisted on getting involved in technical stuff that is way beyond the ability of your primitive monkey brain. Technical stuff that is way important, I shot back. So the ship doesn't drift in space the next time one of you AIs has a freaking glitch.
Okay, he mumbled. Maybe you have a point.
Is that all?
No.
I want to talk about something. Are you capable of discussing something serious?
Why wouldn't I be?
You said you are a walrus and you were singing about mayonnaise.
Did not.
The words "did too" were on the tip of my tongue when I reminded myself that Skippy would happily throw together a subroutine to say "did not" until the end of time. Arguing with him is generally a waste of time. Sorry, I must have misheard you. As if I would ever describe myself as a smelly marine animal. Never heard anything so ridiculous in my life.
I said I'm sorry.
Well, you should be.
Is that all? I was rather busy.
No, that's not all. Remember back when we framed the boss Farrakh for our destruction of two Max Salt ships and the kiddies gave the birds a beatdown to retaliate?
Do I? How could I forget?
Ah, those were good times, Joe.
Yeah, except for the part that at the time we thought there was no way to prevent the imminent destruction of Earth.
Of course, he sputtered.
What about it?
One of the first things the kiddies did was blow up a moon that had a Boss Farrakh research base inside it.
Hoo boy, they sure did. The kiddies blew the hell out of that moon. Sometimes when I'm feeling down, I replay that sensor data. Watching that always cheers me up.
That is such a heartwarming story.
Hey, he sniffed. I'm not even going to mention the stuff you watch on the internet.
Probably a good idea, I said quickly. My point is, you told us how the kiddies did it.
Uh-huh. They smacked it with a space rock.
A really fast space rock.
Close enough, yes. Joe, I didn't tell you at the time, but
that scared the shit out of me, he admitted in a quiet tone.
It scared me, too.
The incident had done more than just frighten me for a moment. For the next week, I had trouble getting to sleep. Seeing a moon get smashed into pieces had gotten me depressed and doubting myself more than usual. How could we fight aliens who had thousands of advanced technology warships and could shatter an entire moon? Yes, it was not a large moon. If I remember correctly, it was only about 1,000 miles across. Compared to other moons, it was small. Basically an asteroid and barely large enough for its own gravity to pull it into a spherical shape. Still, it was solid, and the rock coming in at 1/3 of light speed had punched completely through. The rock blasted from one side of the moon to the other, roughly the distance between Boston and Chicago. Think about that. If that rock had been targeted at Valkyrie, the crew would never know what happened. 1 minute, Skippy would be annoying us with his blah, 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 and the next second, he would be drifting alone in space, wondering what happened to the ship and why he was alone. Shit. We had no defense against a kinetic weapon like that.
Okay, so, he asked, other than making both of us nervous, why did you mention that busted moon?
The rock that hit the moon was a one-time thing, right? But you also told me there is a rumor the kiddies have a whole bunch of darts flying around the galaxy at relativistic speeds, darts with jump drives.
It's more than a rumor and less than established fact, Joe. Until I actually see one, I won't know they exist. But I am about 99% sure the rumor is true.
Why are you asking about this?
Damn. If one fast-moving rock is scary, it is terrifying to think of the kiddies having a whole fleet of relativistic impactors or darts or jarts or whatever such things are called.
Wait, you might say. If the Maxalts had relativistic weapons, then why didn't they use them against us in the battle at Snowcone?
The answer is simple. Because Valkyrie wasn't staying in one place long enough for the enemy to target a fast-moving object at us. The relativistic weapon's extreme velocity make it difficult to aim with precision. And if the rumors were true, the Maxalt's darts had their own jump drives. Skippy thought the kiddies would be lucky if one of their darts emerged from a jump within 100 kilometers of the point they aimed for. Accuracy of 100 clicks is good enough for attacking a large object that can't dodge out of the way, but it was useless against a starship. Even if a dart missed our hull by an inch, we would feel no effect other than a brief flare of radiation as the dart slammed into stray molecules in space as it raced past us. Anyway, The threat of being targeted by standard railguns is why our ships constantly move side to side and up and down, except when we were in deep interstellar space. Especially while orbiting a planet, Valkyrie's engines and thrusters pulsed randomly to avoid providing an easy target. The only exception was when launching and recovering dropships, or when we had a star team outside practicing maneuvers. For safety, the ship remained still during those times. That is why the stars usually conducted training in deep space where the ship was likely to be attacked. In flight training, one of the trickiest skills to master is that of flying a dropship into a docking bay during a combat recovery. During combat or the threat of imminent attack, the ship can't hold still just for one incoming dropship, or even a handful of them. The dropship AIs have to coordinate with the ship's AI to reduce shield intensity in the area where the incoming spacecraft will penetrate the defensive screen around the ship. The proximity defense cannons have to cease fire to avoid shredding our own people, and the ship has to communicate its intentions to the approaching pilots so the pilot doesn't expect the ship to go up when instead it goes down. That is the sort of deadly miscommunication that can result in a dropship going splat against the hull armor rather than zipping into an open docking bay. So no, we did not have to worry about the enemy punching straight through our ship with a dart moving at relativistic speed. According to Skippy, we did not have to worry about that. I had my doubts. We did have to worry about the Maxulks pointing one or more of those darts at Earth. Of course, if they devastated our homeworld by blasting the surface with relativistic weapons, that would be a game changer. I would be tempted to trigger our elder weapons, and the kiddies had to know that. At least I hope they knew that. Can you guess how many of those relativistic weapons the kiddies have flying around the galaxy? All I have is rumors to rely on. There could be up to several hundred of them. Once again, you didn't answer my question. That is an annoying habit, Joe. I ask a question, and you give me another question. Well, I'm trying to understand what question to ask, so I don't waste your very valuable time. I looked down like I was embarrassed. Sucking up to Skippy without gagging is an important skill I'd developed. Maybe if you got to the freaking point, we could both save time. Fine. Can you hack into those darts so we can use them?
What?
OMG. He stared at me. Dude, do you have any idea what you're asking? No, which is kinda why I asked you, I said with an implied duh. Clearly you don't have any idea how difficult it would be, even for my incredible magnificence, to take over one of those darts. Okay, I get it. It's difficult to hack into those darts. It's not difficult, it's impossible. Talk me through it. You hack into stuff all the time. Ugh. This totally does not compare to something simple like me taking over that frigate when we were at Snowcone. Joe, right now, I have zero solid information about those darts.
Right. So we'll get the data you need and—
Whoa. Stop right there. Information about the free-flying darts must be the most closely guarded secret the Maxulks have. Over the years, I have gained access to top-secret information by taking this ship and hacking into the enemy fleet at Snowcone. We've had access to their relay stations, and I have cracked every type of encryption they use. So far, I got nothing. Zero information about those darts. Wherever they keep that data, it is locked up tight. My guess is the codes to activate, target, and launch those darts are in some archive deep under the surface of a planet we can't get to. At Snowcone, I had access to some of Admiral Reichert's top-secret data archive, and there wasn't even a hint about superweapons. If a senior admiral like Reichert doesn't have the codes to launch those darts, I could not even guess who does have access to those codes. But, he sighed, your monkey brain is too stupid to let it go, so let me explain why what you ask is physically impossible. Please do. He was probably going into Nerdnik-level detail about the subject. All I could do was keep my mouth shut and endure it. My bold talk about forcing the Maxulks to clean up their mess was turning out to be an empty boast, and we had no backup plan. No group of aliens would help us disperse the cloud at Earth unless we could guarantee the Maxulks would not attack them for assisting us. The Spiders had made it clear they would not allow anyone in their coalition to help us. They were taking a passive-aggressive approach that was just as deadly as the actively-aggressive strategy of the Maxulks. We had no weapons that could hit the kiddies hard enough to make them clean up their mess. Our last hope was to use their own weapons against them. Okay. Whew, where do I start? Explaining this to you is like... I'll break it down Barney style. Each one of those darts must have an AI. Inside the memories of each AI is a set of single-use codes. A message directing a dart to attack a target will have multiple layers of codes to authenticate the sender. Remember, the Maxalts will have installed safety procedures to prevent an enemy from using their weapons against them, and the only enemy they're worried about are the Rindaloo. So, let's say to convince a dart that you are authorized to activate it, you need to send a message containing 1,000 code words. 1,000? It is probably way more than a mere 1,000, but let's go with that. The dart receives an authentication signal containing 1,000 words, and it compares that message to the 1,000 words stored in its memory. If even one word is wrong or is out of sequence, the authentication is rejected. But it's worse than that, actually, he continued almost gleefully. The authentication signal must be encrypted in a particular way so the 1,000 words will be revealed only if the message was encrypted using a one-time cipher key that exactly matches the key inside the Dart AI's memory. Do you see the problem, Joe? I can't even guess a single one of those words, nor do I have any clue how the message should be encrypted. But you hack into codes all the time. No, I don't. Yeah, you do. You have seen me cheat, Joe. Allow me to explain, he said in his boastful, gosh darn it, I am awesome tone, not his dreaded Professor Nerdnik will bore you to death tone. First, you have to understand the actual authentication process inside the Dart's AI. While I don't know the specific architecture of that particular type of AI's matrix, I am familiar with how the Maxalts design their AIs. When the signal comes in, it is recorded by a set of receivers who compare notes to assure they all got the same message. Next, the message is sent to a set of decryption subroutines which request the key from an encryption archive. Those subroutines unwind the encryption to reveal the actual message, and they compare notes to assure they all see the same unencrypted message. The clear message is then passed to a set of authentication subroutines which request the stored code words from a memory archive. You can probably guess the next step. The authentication subroutines compare the message to the stored codes to verify they match. The last step is for a validation subroutine to ping the authentication subroutines and get a yes from each one of them. That is where I cheat. How? By hacking directly into the validation subroutine. At the end of that whole process I described is a query from the master AI to that one subroutine asking whether the message is authentic. That poor little subroutine wants to scream no, but I make it